Some people find it harder than other people to make a schedule. You know, one thing you might consider doing is doing the personality test at understandmyself.com and seeing what you're like. You know, maybe you're particularly low in conscientiousness, in which case making a schedule and sticking to a routine, an orderly routine, is going to be quite difficult for you. But that'll at least help you understand, perhaps, at least some of the problem. Maybe you're high in negative emotion or neuroticism, and so you worry too much about making a schedule, and that just stops you from doing it. I would say, well, first thing to do is, there's two things you could do, first of all. The first thing you might want to do is figure out why you want to make a schedule to begin with. So you talked about goals. Well, what is it that you want to accomplish? The future authoring program at selfauthoring.com, another one of our websites, helps people make a detailed plan for the future. And so you can't really have a schedule without having a plan, because the activities you schedule should be intelligently related to goals you wish to achieve that are important to you. And so you need to have goals that you wish to achieve that are important to you, and you have to know what they are. And that's complicated, right? That's like a plan for your life. So it's very difficult. And so that's why we produced this exercise, which helps step you through the process of deciding what you want and need. There's a present authoring program there too that helps you identify your virtues and your faults. And part of your plan can involve capitalizing on those virtues and rectifying those faults. And so that can be an interesting addition to this process. But in any case, you have to figure out what you want. And then you have to figure out how to decompose what you want into actionable steps, right? And those would be the sorts of things that you could put in a schedule. Now, that would mean that your schedule would hypothetically consist of things that you maybe you don't exactly want to do, although that would be good, but at least you understand the importance of doing and are therefore somewhat motivated to do. And then you need to break those steps down into small enough increments that you're highly likely to undertake them. You know, so for example, this is a trivial example, maybe you have to do a report on a given topic for school, and you're not very good at that. Well, you know, maybe you could go to the library one day and just check out the library. That might be enough. And then maybe you could go to the library and take out a book. And then maybe you could open the book and look through it. Those would be on different days. And then maybe you could sit down and read the first page of the book. And if you can't do that, then the first paragraph. You know, you have to negotiate with yourself and figure out what the largest step you would take towards your goal is that you would take. And if you don't do it, then you make the step smaller and smaller until you find something that you would do. The next thing you need to do, potentially, is to familiarize yourself with a scheduler like Google Calendar. So the first thing to do is open it. And then maybe to figure out how to put in a task and then a repeating task. And might be a pretty simple one to begin with. It's like, well, why don't you list waking up and specify a time, or going to bed and specifying a time, an approximate time anyways, or put in the schedule when you eat. And those are things you do every day. And so that's something you're pretty likely to do. And so that's a success for you. And then, well, then you can start by putting in something small. Maybe you need to read. Maybe you need to exercise. Maybe you need to have a social event with people. Maybe you need to watch TV, a movie, whatever. It doesn't matter what it is. Hopefully it's something you want to do. Put it in the schedule. And you could start by scheduling the things that you would like to do. So you can imagine, well, I like going out to movies. I like going to the mall. I like hanging around with my friends. I like watching TV. I like reading a book. I like listening to music. Well, then schedule those things. And so then you think, well, that means I'm forcing myself to do them. It's not that. It's that now you're allowing yourself time to do them, right? So the schedule becomes a means of you getting what you want instead of an external jailer who punishes you every time you deviate from requirement. So you have to make friends with the schedule, and the schedule has to be your friend, your ally. I shouldn't use that word, but you know what I mean. It should work for you and not against you. It's not, you're not generating an external tyrant. You know, you are generating something that you could be held to, you know, and that's be responsible to. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It can be somewhat burdensome, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. But generally, you should approach it as if this is something that will help you get what you want. And it's also a pretty good way of controlling anxiety, you know, because one of the most common sources of anxiety is just not knowing what to do. And people often think about that as boredom, and it is boredom to some degree. It can be, but it can also be very anxiety provoking. It's like, well, what should I do? I don't know what to do. Well, I have to do something. There's all these things I could do, and I don't want to make that decision every hour. So a schedule that you design that you like can be an incredible relief. And one thing we do know is that conscientious people tend to be lower in negative emotion. And it looks like that's a causal consequence, is that orderly people, for example, because they order their environment and make it more predictable, then they're less likely to be anxious, because we're often made anxious by what is unpredictable. So generating a view of your life that consists of valued goals that you want to attain, and then steps by which those might be attained, and the Future Authoring Program helps you figure all that out. Well, then you can ally that with a schedule, and then, you know, not only do you know what you're doing, you know that what you're doing is moving you towards something you want, and that's rewarding. And having your time structured like that and attaining those goals is pleasurable and anxiety reducing. So, you know, that's a pretty good deal, all things considered. And you can start stupid and slow. Like I said, just throw some things in that you're pretty likely to do, and fill in the schedule with broad strokes. And then as you get familiar with it and comfortable with it, and maybe even happy with it, you can fill in the details and start to use it in a more sophisticated way. Everyone I know who's accomplished, almost everyone I know who's accomplished, does structure their time explicitly in that manner. They've learned to do that over the years. Now, not everyone does that. Really, really entrepreneurial people might have a harder time with it, especially if they're low in conscientiousness. But and then with regard to the personality test, you know, maybe you do a personality test, the personality test I mentioned, say, and you find out that you're agreeable but low in conscientiousness. Well, so it's going to be harder for you to stick to a schedule, but you do like to please other people. So that's one of the things that you could schedule. You'd be highly likely to do that. If you're extroverted, you could schedule time, you know, socializing with people. If you're introverted, you could schedule time by yourself, walking in nature, for example, or doing whatever else it is that you might want to do by yourself. If you're open, you could schedule in creative time, and then you'd be motivated to do those things. So you're having a hard time disciplining yourself. That's par for the course. You know, I mean, like I said, really conscientious people are more inclined in that direction. But it's hard to discipline yourself in relationship to a goal. You know, it's like training a cart horse to pull a cart. It's difficult. And so you start with little things, and maybe little things that you want to do, and then you can proceed to harder things that you don't want to do so much, you know, for their extrinsic or intrinsic utility, but you have to do them because they're related to something important. You get disciplined across time if you do that, and incremental improvement that's sustained is extremely powerful from the perspective of transformation. You can think about this. I think it's worth thinking about, because I think this is how we think of each other. And I think this is how we treat each other. And I think this is what we upbraid ourselves for when we fail. You wake up in the morning, and what is it that confronts you? Now, you could say that it's the material reality of the circumstances around you, and that you're driven like clockwork by that. But that isn't how it appears phenomenologically, I don't believe. I don't see that that's how we see ourselves when we awaken in the morning. What we see in front of us is a field of potential, constrained to a large degree for some of us and wider for others, but still definitely present. And that's the domain of what could be that day. And I think the day is the right level of analysis. And you wake up and you confront the world and you think, well, here's a variety of ways that things could play themselves out today. And that's that field of potential that's in front of you. It could go this way, or it could go this way, or it could go that way. And you know that maybe you have difficult decisions ahead of you, and you know that perhaps you're motivated to avoid some of them, or maybe not to take the difficult decision, but to take the easy way out. And you have some inkling of how things would go if you did it properly, or if you avoided it, or if you took the easy way out. You can understand how the future would be likely to unfold if you took any of those patterns of action. And then you get up and you decide to act or to not act in accordance with your decisions. And as a consequence, you turn the potential that characterizes the future into the actuality of the present and the past. And so to me, what that means is that whatever your consciousness is, which in the oldest sense is the thing that has, what would you say, it's that which dwells within you that's made in the image of the God who created things at the beginning of time, that's the idea, is that the implementation of that transforms the chaotic potential that confronts you in the form of the indeterminate future into the actual world. And that's what we do. And we do that as a consequence of our moral choices. And in Genesis, the claim is that insofar as God used the Logos to perform exactly the same function, then the habitable order that was created was good. And that's insisted upon repeatedly. And so there's a deep ethic there, and it's a very deep ethical idea. And the idea is that you have within your grasp the possibility to take the world despite its suffering and its malevolence, and to confront it in a manner that, as a consequence of applying truth, will transform what you produce out of that potential into what is good. And that's a call for a particular form of ethical being. And it's on you. Is that you make decisions to go this way or that way, and some of the decisions lead up to something that's positive, and some of the decisions lead down to something that's negative. And if enough of us make the decision to move down into what's negative, then that's exactly what happens. And we create situations around us that are so close to hell that the distinction is merely semantic. And so you might say, well, you're no believer in heaven, and perhaps you're no believer in God, but you could easily be a believer in the ability of your own cowardly indecision and determination to use deceit instead of confronting things courageously and truthfully to produce something around you that's hell for all intents and purposes. And I think that that was the lesson of the 20th century. I think that's exactly what happened. I think that the reason it happened is because individuals abandoned their moral responsibility. And that moral responsibility is, in some sense, absolute enough to be unbearable. Having said that, so then my conclusion, because of all that, and for other reasons as well, was that, well, it was true that life is suffering tainted by malevolence, but that there was a power of spirit that characterized the human being that enabled him or her to confront that forthrightly with nobility of purpose and to transcend the suffering and constrain the malevolence, and that that was within our grasp. And that what that meant fundamentally was that despite the undeniable structural reality of finitude and evil, that the spirit of the human being was so powerful in its potential that that could be confronted and accepted as a fundamental responsibility, and then transcended and repaired as a consequence. And so that was an inversion of the most pessimistic possible view, I suppose, which is that life is ineradicably suffering and malevolence, into the opposite view, which is that if that is taken on voluntarily, then it's something that can be transcended and rectified. And that's the sacred responsibility of every single person. And worse, that the abdication of that responsibility, which is in some sense virtually unbearable in its weight, that the abandonment of that or the avoidance of it produces a void in the structure of reality that's filled by something that's hellish. And so it's not only that you fail to make things better when you could by stopping doing the things that you know to be wrong, but that if you don't take forthright action, then the space you leave is filled by something that's dreadful. And so the conclusion of all that was that the collectivists were wrong. And those who insisted that the individual was the sovereign foundation of the state, and that each individual has a divine element that's the rationale for that foundational sovereignty and the reason for our equality before God and the law, that's correct in the most fundamental of ways. And so what I've been attempting to do since then, and I guess that's part of the reason why you're all here, I suppose, is to suggest to individuals that there's far more to you than you would like to believe, and that whether you manifest that in the world properly makes far more difference than you would like to imagine. And the downside of that is the crushing weight of that voluntary adoption of your moral burden. But the upside is the discovery of the nobility that's within you, that's of sufficient force and power to be aligned in some sense with the most fundamental realities of the world, and that constitutes a sufficient wellspring of strength, if drawn upon properly, for you to bear the suffering and malevolence that characterizes the world without becoming corrupted as a consequence. I'm 40, but I feel like a child watching everyone around me get older and die. So I'm homesick for the past instead of accepting the terrifying present. How can I stop mourning the past? Now, you're suffering from what Freud described as reminiscences of the past. You're possessed by reminiscences. They won't get out of your mind. And what that means to me is, well, it's one of two things. One is that there's things in your past that you need to understand more deeply. And that's why they're still calling to you. And there are things in your past that you had, perhaps, that you need to have in the present and the future. And so you could do the past authoring program and write out your past. It asks you to detail the most emotionally significant events that occurred during different epochs or stages of your life. So you have to break your life into a number of stages. I think we recommended 6, but you can break it into as many as you want or as few. And then to detail out the significant positive and negative occurrences, you know, that stand out in your memory from those times. And that'll kind of help put the past to rest, but it also might highlight for you what it is that you're nostalgic for. And then that can help you figure out what to aim for in the future. And so, you know, it sounds like you're rather hopeless about the present and by implication the future. And maybe that's because you don't have a richly enough developed conception of what it could be. So you could go back to your past and find out what it is that you wanted and had, and then you need to make a plan for how you might obtain that in the future. Now, it's a bit more complicated than that, because you talked about death, you know, and so you may be longing in some sense for a return to in a state of blissful ignorance where you weren't concerned about mortality. And, you know, the only real medication for that, I think, that's real is to live as worthwhile a life as you can, as full a life, so you don't have regrets. I'm not sure that so much that people are afraid of death. They may be afraid of not living enough. And maybe if you lived enough, you could let it go when it was time. I think there's some truth in that. And so if you're overly afraid of death, it may be because you have a lot of unlived life in you. And you can go back to the past and you can find out what you needed and perhaps had then. And then you can strive to attain that in the present and the future. And those exercises could, at least in principle, help you with that. So what are you missing, right? What are you missing that the past had for you? And maybe you write that down, like, well, I had this, it was really important to me, and I, you know, had a loving relationship with someone, and I don't have that now. I had the security of a comfortable home life, and I don't have that now. So, well, those are things that now become ambitions, right? Because a lack is, an ambition and a lack are mirror images of one another. So if you can identify what you lack, you can derive an ambition from that. And you might say, well, that's impossible. It's like, well, you decompose it into small steps. And that's complicated. But so life is complicated. So there's no way around that. You're somewhere, because you have to be somewhere. Now, you might not know where that is, which means that the somewhere that you are is chaotic, in which case you need to go over your past in great detail and figure out where you are. It's like you're lost, right? You're lost, and the problem with being lost is when you're lost, you don't know where to go, and the problem with not knowing where to go is there's a million places that you could go, and a million places is too many places for you to go without dying. So being lost is not good. So you need to know where you are. One of the things that we built online, my partners and I, is this program called Past Authoring that helps people lay out the narrative of their past to identify, to break their life down into six stages, epochs we call them, and then to identify the emotionally significant moments in each epoch and to write them out, what happened negatively, what happened positively, what the consequences were, what you derived from it, perhaps what you could have done differently, perhaps what you learned from it, all of that, so that you can narrow in, zero in, on determining precisely where it is that you are right now. And people are often loath to do that because they actually don't want to know, because they'd rather be spread out in a sort of half-blind manner in the fog, hoping that the place that they're at is better than it really is, and deluding themselves by remaining vague, than to figure out, I'm right here, right now, with these specific problems. But it's actually better to do that, because if you have a set of specific problems and you've really narrowed them down and really specified them, then you can probably start fixing them. And you can start fixing them in micro ways, bit by bit. But there's no way you can do that without knowing where you are. It's impossible. And you can kind of tell if you don't know where you are. It's quite straightforward. If you are haunted by reveries of the past, for events that are older than approximately 18 months, if they continue to come up in your mind over and over, in your dreams over and over, you haven't extracted the world out from your past experiences. The potential is still trapped in the past. And to confront the potential means to confront the dragon of the past. And of course, that's terrifying, and it can seriously be terrifying. So for example, maybe you're vague and ill-formed and ill-defined because you were abused very badly when you were a child, 4 years old, something like that. And maybe you were abused by a family member, because that's generally who does the abusing. And so that just makes it worse. And then what that means is that you've had an implicit encounter with malevolent evil that
No, you've had a direct encounter with malevolent evil, but you have an implicit hypothesis of malevolent evil that's plaguing you. It's still there. It's trapped in the memories, right? It's trapped in the representational structure. And as an adult, you're now faced with the necessity of articulating that fully before you have any chance whatsoever of freeing yourself from it. And so that's no joke. Lots of times people have to go into the past. That's what the psychoanalysts do. And say, look, here is something came along and just bloody well knocked me over. And it isn't even that I repressed it, which I think was... Well, we won't talk about Freud's errors because Freud was a genius, so we'll just leave him alone. But sometimes it's not repression. It's just that terrible things happen to people at such a young age that there isn't a bloody chance in hell that they can figure out why they happened or what to do with them or what they mean. And then you can carry that with you, and you carry it with you. It's like your body encounters the world in stages, and it happens very rapidly. Well, it can extend over years, but the initial stages happen very rapidly. So, for example, if you're walking down the road and you hear a loud noise behind you, it'll go like this. That's a predator defense response, by the way. You crouch down, and that's to stop something from jumping on your back and getting at your neck too easily. That's like a few hundred milliseconds. It's really fast, or even faster than that. And it better be, because something like a snake, we'll say, can nail you just right now, so you better be fast. But it's low resolution. It's like danger snake, something like that, or danger predatory cat. It's that fast. And then you can unravel that and categorize it, but that takes time. You do that with emotion, and then you do it with cognition. You can do that with long-term thinking, you know, because maybe you've encountered someone specifically malevolent and predatory at work. That happens to people a lot, who's operating as a destructive bully and who seems to have no positive function whatsoever and is only living that out. And then you don't know what to do about it. So you're in prey mode. I don't mean this kind of mode, although that would help too. But I mean, you're acting like a prey animal, and then you have this terribly complex thing to decompose, which is, what the hell's up with this person? Why are they making my life miserable? What is it about me that allows them to make my life miserable? That's a nasty little road to walk down. And you're stuck with having to decompose it. Maybe you can't. Maybe formulating an explicit philosophy of good and evil to deal with something malevolent in your environment actually just happens to be beyond you. And that could easily be. It's certainly the case for people who are young. And it's the case for plenty of adults as well. It's no simple thing to manage. It's something, too, that often soldiers who have post-traumatic stress disorder have to do because they've encountered terrible things. They've either done them or ran into them. And they need to update their moral model of the world, or they end up in something close enough, closely approximating hell. You need to know where you are. That's this, what is, where are you? So you're navigating, you're a navigator, you're a sailor on an ocean, man. That's what you are. You're a mobile creature. You're going from point A to point B all the time. You're not sitting there glued to a rock like some brainless, you know, sea creature. There's a funny little creature called a hydra, very simple little creature. In its juvenile stage, it has a brain because it swims around, but then when it turns into an adult, it latches itself to a rock and promptly digests its brain. Because if you're just sitting on a rock and you're not moving, you don't need a brain. So, but that's not our issue, right? We're zipping around in the world, and so we're navigating agents. And so to navigate, there's two things you need to know. And the first is, where the hell are you? Exactly, precisely, right? Razor sharp. What's good about you and what's bad about you? By your own reckoning. You don't have to... You can ask other people, but this is a game you play yourself. It's like, as far as I'm concerned, I'm taking stock. What is it that's okay about me and what needs some work? And you got to watch to not be too self-critical when you're doing that too, because that can just be another kind of flaw.
People work to some degree so they don't starve. Now, that's a very negative way of looking at it, but much work, if not all, is also routine and socialization and commitment and meaning. I talked with a psychologist yesterday from North Dakota State who wrote, he studies meaning from an existential perspective, and he wrote an article in Newsweek criticizing the idea of universal basic income. Mm-hmm. And the reason he criticized it was because, well, he noted, for example, that One of the things that drives people to suicide is the idea that they're a functionless burden. And so imagine that you identify a segment of the population and you essentially say to them, "We can't think of anything useful for you to do, but it would be annoying to watch you starve, so here's some money." I mean, I'm being very cynical about that, but it isn't obvious, especially that conscientious people would respond to that with anything but despair. And so, obviously, we need to take care of dispossessed people, but that's a complicated problem, and merely giving people money is not a sufficiently sophisticated solution. And that does go to the dignity of work, right? The need. We're like pack animals. We need to pull. Now, some people more than others. It's really tightly associated with trait conscientiousness, one of the big five personality traits. But conscientious people who have nothing to do, they despair. It's not in their nature to not work.
And I think that's absolutely right. I mean, when we have constantly asked about veteran suicide, and what I say is the why aren't we talking about active duty military suicide? Why is it when you become a veteran, you're somehow more prone to suicide? Now, there's some in PTSD. This is very interesting. My intuition is that it's a loss of purpose and mission.
Well, one of the things, I studied military people for a long time with the U.S. Naval Academy. That's a whole story in and of itself, I'll tell you. But we were looking at what predicts military success among their students. We could predict it quite well. And the most salient predictor, apart from general cognitive ability, which predicts virtually anything complex, and that's IQ essentially, was trait conscientiousness. And the thing about conscientious people is that they live for duty. They are like sled dogs, man. If they don't have a purpose, they'll become desperate. And it's like the upside to conscientiousness is it makes you more successful because you're a harder worker, let's say. You put in more hours. But the downside is if you lose your job, for example, you're made superfluous for one reason or another. You'll eat yourself up with despair.
Radical leftists, they react to me this way. They say, "Well, you hold a position of privilege and power." And I think, first, you don't know a goddamn thing about me, and you have no idea how I got to my position of privilege and power. And it was no birthright, I can tell you that. I was a small, like, thick-glassed, intellectual, athletic child. You know, I was a year younger than my peers. I suffered plenty of, what would you say, trouble for my loud mouth and my intellect when I was growing up. You know, I had my struggles. I'm not complaining about it. The point is that you can't attribute privilege to a class of people, you know, and you can't attribute power to people who happen to occupy a position of competence and authority either. There's some possibility that they occupy that because they worked hard and were fortunate, let's not forget about that, and had some good social support and didn't have some horrible disease, thank God. But you can't just make the case that the position is there as a reward. It's not there as a reward at all. It's there as a consequence of the person offering something valuable to those who want to pay for it. And the reason you pay for them isn't to reward them. It isn't so that you give them a pat on the back and say, "Well, you're a good person and, you know, you deserve this position." It's because you're saying to them, "Produce. We find what you're producing of value. And so we're going to give you what you need in order to be motivated to keep doing it. But it's not because we like you. It's not because we respect your rights. It has nothing to do with equity. It's we're trying to get every goddamn thing we can from you as fast as possible. And we're going to pay you to do it." And so people deserve their damn pay. And the reason they deserve it isn't because it's a reward. It's because that's how you get productive people to do things that are difficult and time-consuming and that perhaps they wouldn't do on their own accord, to continue doing them so you can benefit from it. So the whole notion that, you know, we're awarding positions of privilege to oppressive patriarchal types, it's like, we just have to get rid of that. Enough of that. That's nonsense. Citizens have the inalienable right to benefit from the results of their own honest labor. That's a good one. Yes, that's a conservative truism. You know, why? Well, it isn't because you're good-hearted and you want them to have money. It's because they'll work if you let them benefit from the work, and you want them to work, because if they work, then they do things that you need. It's as simple as that. It's self-interest, and it's the right kind of self-interest. So if you work hard, it's like, great, have your money. You know, and you hear people all the time talking about how corrupt our society is and how the 1%, you know, occupies this pinnacle position. You know, the 1% turns over pretty damn fast, just so you know it. So you have about a 10% chance of spending at least 1 year in the top 1% chance during your life. I think that's right. I think it's 10%. It might be higher than that. But it's fast. It's the 1% is stable as a phenomena, but it turns over very rapidly in terms of who occupies it. And it's the same in every society. The wealth is always distributed inequitably. It's a natural law. You can look it up. It was discovered by a guy named Wilfred Pareto back in the late 1800s. Goods tend to distribute themselves inequitably. It can be a problem, but it doesn't mean that there's something fundamentally corrupt about the social structure that's driving it in that direction. And like, you don't want some filthy rich geniuses lying around? Like, maybe you do. I mean, look at what Elon Musk is doing, for God's sake. Maybe he should have 10 times as much money as he has. He's going to launch a rocket every 5 days to Mars in the next 10 years, right? He wants to wipe out fossil fuel cars, and he might do it. He wants to revolutionize the transportation system, and he might do it. He wants to put us on the damn solar grid with his new batteries, and he might do it. It's like, oh no, he has a couple of billion dollars. Well, God only knows what he's going to produce with that. It's like, so obviously there's going to be some corrupt rich plutocrats who do nothing but smoke cigars and snort cocaine. They're not going to live very long anyways. But there's lots of people out there who have the money they have because they would really like to do interesting and creative things with it, not because they're interested in gathering more, you know, paper money to stuff in their mattress and to like to feel the smooth delight of gold coins between their fingers before they go to bed. Like, what kind of attitude is that towards people who've made their fortune? You know, you think that about Steve Jobs? You think that about Bill Gates? I mean, good God, I don't know how those people made a lot of money, but man, thank God they were around, you know? They've given us some tools that are just absolutely unbelievable. So, you know, maybe we could leave the jealousy of the successful behind for a while and notice now and then that some of the people who got to where they are actually deserve to get to where they are, and we should be thankful that they exist. That would be nice. A little gratitude.
There's good literature showing that conscientious people who lose their jobs are much more likely to become depressed. Mm. Yeah, because these are fundamental sub-personalities. That's part of the way that you might look at it. So you're made of, you have a position in each of these traits, and that gives you a personality. If you're really, really high in openness, let's say, if you don't create, you die. Like, that's your life. If you're high in extroversion, if you're not with people, you dry up and blow away. So these are deeply rooted inside of you, and conscientiousness is a trait like that. And so people who, especially conscientious people, they need purpose. It's not optional. It can be their defining characteristic. So, and that's true for military people. I mean, the military is built for conscientious people.
It has to be.
Yeah. Well, it's, you see, one of the things the Navy, the Naval Academy wanted us to do was to see if we could select for creativity as well, right? Because they wanted independent thinkers and so forth. And it's really tough because most of the military regimen is suited primarily to conscientious people. Now, if you're open and creative, that might work really well if you're in an advanced leadership role. But the question is, how the hell do you get there? Because if you're not highly conscientious, you're going to get in trouble as you rise through the ranks. And lots of companies have this problem, by the way, because at the low end, conscientiousness is vital and openness might be merely disruptive. First of all, I think it's really worth thinking about what success means. And I tried to do that a lot in both the books. It's really fun to make other people successful. Like, this is one of the reasons capitalism, I would say, gets a really bad rap and an unfair rap. Like, the people I've known who have been successful in the capitalist enterprise, and a lot of them are entrepreneurs, rather than managers, let's say, that's the population I've been exposed to. And this was the same among the professoriate, for that matter. One of the great pleasures the people that I've seen who I respect took was in mentoring. And so don't underestimate the radical satisfaction that's associated with helping other people develop. One of the reasons that good professors, well, and good businessmen love to be in the position they're in is because they can identify young people who are promising and open up doors of opportunity to them. It's really intrinsically motivating. And so, you know, when you think of capitalism, for example, or success as only a competitive enterprise, that's a real mistake, because there's that aspect of it that's there everywhere in every enterprise I've ever seen. So success, real success, means you're successful in a way that makes other people around you successful. You need both of those. And that's also really good for your conscience, because then you're not working at the expense of anyone else. Quite the contrary, right? You're lifting the tide that lifts all boats. Maybe you're simultaneously elevating your own relative status, but it's not unreasonable to put that in as a constraining requirement. It has to help other people. Well, it helps you. And I would say the way we're wired, now some people are more selfish than others, but I would still say human beings are unbelievably social and reciprocal. That's built into us at an incredibly deep level. And it can go wrong, and we can get cynical and malevolent and bitter and work at counter purposes to it. But to be of service to your fellow man, your family members, your broader community, there are virtually no pleasures that compete with that. So, and so that's partly why it is useful to do a critique of mere materialism. And materialistic satisfactions are pretty fleeting. They're not non-existent, but they don't have the deep and lasting satisfaction of successful mentoring, for example, and the relationships that build out of that. So I don't think there is any success at all without moral success. In fact, I think that success without moral success is actually a form of torture. You know, if you don't, let's say you don't feel you deserve anything, because you're not being a good person, and that's your own judgment. And let's assume that you're accurate. You're not, because some people will judge themselves far too harshly. But let's just say, you know, you have reasons to have your conscience bothering you, and you're not successful. Well, at least you don't feel the continual injustice of that. You think, well, I'm a son of a bitch, but I don't have anything. But then let's say you're successful. Well, you know that's all ill-gotten. How can that do any? And then maybe you have to rationalize constantly to live with it. Everything you collect around you is nothing but a source of torment and a constant reminder that you're criminal in your fundamental orientation, that you've ruined people on your mad scramble to the top. Jesus, you don't want that. Like, you seriously don't want that. And no amount of relative material status is going to even come close to rectifying that. You want your conscience to be clean, clear. You want your interpersonal relationships to be honest. You want to be reliable and dependable. And if you can add exciting and adventurous to that, so much the better. But success means, to be successful means to be good. You really are your only comparison group, especially as you get older, because your life is so idiosyncratic and peculiar that look, you have to care what other people think. It's stupid to think otherwise, because you have to be social and you have to be aware of what other people are doing and all of that. So this isn't psychopathic individuality, but it is genuinely true that no one has your set of opportunities and limitations. And so the comparison just isn't real. It can't be sufficiently multidimensional. You know, because maybe you see someone who's rich. I've met many people who are very, very rich. And you can look at their lives and they have these huge houses and material plenty. But, and they're shielded from many catastrophes that would hit someone without those resources harder. But their lives are still full of exactly the same troubles that characterize human life in general.
And so you compare yourself on one dimension. You don't see, well, the person's worked 80 hours a week for 40 years and it's blown all his relationships out of the water. It's like, yes, he's rich, but he's also old now. You know, he's 60. And one of the best predictors of wealth is age. You know, really, do you want to be young and poor or old and rich? It's like, I'd pick young and poor because you can't buy youth. And so, and that's something that's worth considering. But you don't know what burdens the people you're jealous of are carrying. So leave it be. It's not helpful to you to be envious. Who knows what price you pay for hyper-specialization? You know, and I learned that looking at, you know, power mad C-suite types. Well, first of all, they're generally not power mad, because power is actually an unbelievably unstable way of establishing authority. You get slaughtered if you're not reciprocal in most reasonably functioning organizations. And if you're in an organization that only rewards the exercise of power, the probability that that organization is going to fail in totality is extraordinarily high. Because it's a tyrannical organization, it'll lose touch with its customers. So the C-suite types, they're working nonstop. Corporate lawyers in New York, you know, they make $700 an hour, but they work all the time. And there are people who are suited for that. But it isn't obvious that that's for everyone, or that it should be, or that it's even desirable. Now, it's a temperamental issue to a large degree. You know, many of those people are hyper conscientious. And so if they'll work wherever you put them, what they would do is work. That's who they are. And it's biological as well. It's not all biological, because traits are affected by learning and by environment in complex ways. But a huge chunk of it is that you're born like that, and that has advantages and disadvantages. So conscientiousness is a good example. It's a good predictor of long-term life success. But people who are conscientious tend to tear themselves apart if they become unemployed, for example. You know, sometimes you get laid off. You worked hard, but you get laid off. Well, people who are conscientious will tear themselves into pieces with guilt in that situation, because they tend to attribute so much responsibility to themselves. And so there's a price to be paid for conscientiousness. It opens you up to a certain set of vulnerabilities. So, you know, and you might be somewhat unbearable to your family too, because all you ever do is work. You know, you think, well, you want to be a good, you want your father, maybe your husband, perhaps your wife, to be a good provider, but you want them to do that at the expense of everything else?
There's that imbalance where someone can be morally good and a fantastic person, but in a materialistic society seem to be a failure because they haven't acquired a great deal.
Well, that definitely is a problem. When you have productive people, that's a problem in how the it's a measurement problem in some sense. You know, economic success is generally associated with intelligence and conscientiousness. So there is a rough correlation between ability, let's say, even moral ability, and success. Now, I'm not making too much of that, but I do know, look, if you're going to be a successful businessman, especially across business person, across multiple dimensions, multiple enterprises, you bloody well better be honest, because it's going to catch up with you, man. And the probability that you're going to be a successful crook multiple times is very, very low. You can do that, but you have to move constantly, right? So your reputation doesn't keep up with you. So there is some association between success and moral virtue, thank God. But it's a rough approximation, and there's plenty of exceptions. It's very hard for creative people to monetize their productivity, for example. So you have unrewarded virtue, and that's a flaw of the monetary system. It means we haven't been able to. And you might say the same thing applies to such things as our inability to pay homemakers. Now, why don't we pay homemakers? Well, it's because what they produce isn't monetizable for 20 years. And our economic system isn't sophisticated enough to figure out how to pay people for returns that are that, you know, pushed off into the future. That doesn't make it right, but we don't know how to fix it technically.
right? I mean, if you're a venture capitalist and you want to invest in something, you want a tenfold return on your investment within a handful of years. You can't afford to invest over a 20-year period. And so that makes it really rough on homemakers because we're not sophisticated enough to monetize it. So it's a measurement problem. But unless you can figure out a better way of doing it, you're stuck with what we've got. Imagine you ask something like, what's the meaning of life? And I would say, well, you should reformat that question because it's not a good question because it implies that there's a meaning to life, a meaning. And perhaps there isn't a meaning. You could ask, well, where do people derive the meanings in their life? Well, you tell me, but I'll make a little list and see if you can add to it or object to it. You probably need a career or a job. Well, why? Well, because otherwise you'll starve and freeze. Like, it's a necessity. You have to generate enough to protect you from the elements, let's say, to protect you from privation. That's not a consequence of capitalism or anything foolish like that. It's a consequence of hunger and the need for shelter. Capitalism is an attempt to address that, not to cause it. And you could argue that another system might do it better, but even if you did argue that, you can't lay the necessity at the feet of capitalism. You need a career and a job, partly out of necessity, partly because we need to be of service to other people. We need to be of service to the community. It's a deep need for people, especially if they're conscientious and agreeable. You need to be educated to the limits of your intelligence. You need an intimate relationship. You need a family. You need friends. You need to take care of your mental and physical health. You need to regulate the effects that temptations have on you. And you need some sort of higher order spiritual or philosophical pursuit. Well, those are all socially mandated roles to some degree. And you don't want to demolish them because you're left with nothing. Having nothing is not a good place. It's not freedom. That's foolish to think that. Freedom is the ability to choose between jobs, let's say, not to choose whether or not you have a job.
When I was younger, when I was 10 or 12, I used to think that being an adult meant doing whatever you want. It's only when I got older that I realized being an adult actually means having responsibility. A sign of maturity isn't doing whatever you want whenever you feel like it. It's having obligations and responsibilities toward other people.
You just made a case for identity as social responsibility and duty. That's a lot different than identity as felt sense. I mean, it's just not helpful to have your identity be your felt sense because it doesn't buy you anything. And you pointed out that for you, there's some peace in fulfilling your roles properly. So you have a number of games which you chose to some degree voluntarily, but which are also socially structured. You find satisfaction and freedom from anxiety in playing out those roles properly. And that is what people are like. And demolishing those roles, criticizing them as purely oppressive, let's say, is not helpful because it leaves nothing. And that's a terrible state for people to find themselves in, to have nothing. You're very fortunate if you're constrained by a number of functional roles. It's what everybody needs. I mean, some people need less of that than others. If you're highly open in your personality, so fundamentally creative, and you're low in conscientiousness, so you don't like order, you don't need order, well, you know, a little bit of structure goes a long way, but there aren't many people like that who are highly functional. It's also extraordinarily difficult to make your way in the world as a spontaneously creative person. It's very difficult to monetize that. Some people do it extraordinarily well. They're geniuses. Even they're very rarely economically successful. Belief is what you stake your actions on. There's choice in it too, and that's faith, I suppose. So faith isn't the decision to believe things that are preposterous. And there's a substantial amount of confusion about that, I would say, in the religious community and in the non-religious community. So, for example, you can decide that it's better to tell the truth than not to. And it's a decision because you're not basing your action on your observations of the outcome of the actions that stem from that decision. You've decided to look at things in a certain way. So I could say, I've decided to do what I can to say what I believe to be true, because I have decided that, to believe that, to assume that, to have faith in the proposition that there's no better way forward than the truth, no matter what it looks like. And that's the thing. That's why the decision of faith is necessary, because it gives you a particular angle on the evidence. You know, maybe I say something I believe to be true and I get in trouble. And then I might say, well, the fact that I got in trouble indicates that saying what's true wasn't the right thing to do. It's like, no, not necessarily. It might be that saying what I believe to be true was the right thing to do despite the proximal outcome. You have to make decisions about how you're going to interpret the facts. You have to make decisions about that. Those are decisions of faith. And so then you decide what you have faith in. Well, here's some things that I would like to have faith in if I could manage it, if I could be strong enough to manage it, let's say. I'd like to assume that existence is worthwhile and that we should all work for its furtherance and its benefit. And you say, well, is that true? Well, there's a lot of suffering in life. There's a lot of suffering associated with consciousness. You could make the case that there's so much suffering that the whole game is suspect. And that's a valid claim, but it's not a claim I want to make. So I'm not going to live out that claim. I'm going to try to live out the alternate claim. All things considered, I think that would be better. You could say, well, you're justified in altering falsehoods if it's expedient. That's why people lie, and people do lie, and so obviously they believe that to some degree, because otherwise they wouldn't lie. But you could decide that you're not going to do that, because that's wrong. Well, that's not so much an observation as a proposition. I'm going to live my life as if that's wrong. And I think, I mean, I've derived both of those principles, let's say, the wish for the furtherance of being and the idea that truth is redemptive. Those are fundamental Judeo-Christian propositions, maybe the most fundamental Judeo-Christian propositions. They seem to me to be valid, or valid enough to stake my life on. And that's the decision of faith. What are you going to stake your life on? That's manifested in action. It's not manifested in your claims about the explicit contents of your descriptions of the world. This ideal does lurk in our structure. And, you know, you can say, well, it's the internalization of a social ideal. It is that. It's more than that, though. It's probably the internalization of a biological ideal. But it's more than that, because why that biological ideal? Why did that manifest itself rather than some other ideal? These are all ideas I'm trying to work out while I'm writing this next book. See, well, I can give you a bit of a prodrome of that. Men, roughly speaking, gather together in groups to accomplish tasks they regard as significant, important. And they vote among themselves, so to speak, as to who they'll elevate to a position of status and authority. The men are constantly getting together, deciding amongst themselves who they're going to hoist up on their shoulders and carry cheering out of the stadium. And women peel from the top of that. And so the men vote on the best men and the women select them. And that's our evolutionary history. That's sexual selection. We're participating in the joint creation of an ideal that's negotiated between the sexes. And I think that's undeniable biologically.